This is Cincinnati Edition. I'm Mark Caney. A recent survey found that many minorities would rather have a healthcare provider who's of the same race or ethnicity, pointing to a need for a more diverse array of medical providers. And our growing immigrant population is adding to that need. We look at the role race, ethnicity, and cultural background play in patients receiving proper healthcare and efforts to encourage and mentor more minorities to enter careers in medicine. My guests are Dr. Karen Bankston, University of Cincinnati College of Nursing, Associate Dean of Clinical Practice, Partnership, and Community Engagement, Dr. Barbara Tobias with the UC Department of Family and Community Medicine, and the Medical Director of the Health Collaborative of Greater Cincinnati, and also Dr. Gary Leroy, Associate Dean for Student Affairs and Admissions at Wright State University's Boonshoft School of Medicine. You can join the conversation at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And good afternoon, everybody. Thanks for being here.
You're welcome. Thank you for inviting us.
And thanks for having
us.
Thank
you.
Barbara, what do local studies show on this issue?
Yeah, so there is a community health status survey that is sponsored by the Institute for Policy Research at the University of Cincinnati and Interact for Health. And this year, we were able to add three additional questions to find out if our community is concerned about race and ethnicity as a barrier in terms of finding trusted sources of care. And we found out that while only 4% of adults in the community overall report race and ethnicity as a barrier, the number varies dramatically among specific subgroups. African Americans report race and ethnicity as a barrier more than twice as often as white Appalachians and non-white Appalachians. So it's 8% versus 3%. So we have local data that show that many of our citizens aren't finding a trusted source of care. And we know clinically that if there's not a trusted source of care, there's not patient engagement, shared decision making, and more accountability for health. And that has negative health outcomes in terms of cost and illness.
Karen, how wide is the health gap when it comes to the care that minorities are receiving?
Well, you know, we know that we've been talking about this whole notion of health disparities for a long time. When we look at some of the more chronic disorders that exist, when we look at things like hypertension and diabetes and obesity, those disorders that have existed that we're talking about now for a couple of decades, those of us who are African American and some of those of us who are Latina seem to be being disproportionately affected by those disorders. There are some of us who believe that the one of the causes, not the only cause, but one of the causes of that disparity is because there are not enough culturally competent providers to help them through the understanding of the differences in terms of how we eat and how we think about eating and how we exercise and how we think about exercising, etc.
Gary, we know that the diversity in the medical profession is an issue, and it has been for a long time. Do we have an exact picture of diversity in the medical profession, or is it tough to get a specific picture of what workforce diversity is really like?
Yeah, actually, it is. It's a moving target, and it's very difficult to, when you look over these statistics that are quoted out there in the media about what the exact numbers are. When you look at the Association of American Medical Colleges, about every 4 years they do a fact and figure publication, the latest one being in 2010. And they acknowledge right off that these numbers are somewhat skewed, but they do also acknowledge that individuals of racial and ethnic minority backgrounds continue to suffer greater health problems than their white counterparts because of the disparity of individuals that come from similar social backgrounds are just not enough of them out there to take care of those matters. Another publication done by Ohio Health actually these are 2009 figures. They were saying that there are about 755 African-American physicians and 413 Hispanic physicians in Ohio. And again, when you look at the sheer numbers out there, that's not very many, comparatively speaking.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join our conversation. Barbara, there was a research letter in the Journal of the American Medical Association earlier this year. The letter was about the merits of increasing minority representation in medicine. And also, as we were talking about Karen earlier, the same research letter points out that we've been working on this issue for decades and decades to increase minority representation in the medical field, and yet it's still not adequate. Why is that? What are the barriers to achieving this?
Yeah, the solutions are complex, and there's not a single solution to address this. It starts with pipeline. It starts with pre-K universal school access for everyone. It starts with education and opportunities. It starts with minorities looking at the health professions and seeing someone that looks like them. We also have to work on diversity in our C-suites of our hospital systems for the employers who employ our staff and our physicians. So it's a complicated issue that doesn't have a single solution. And it's not really getting better fast. In Cincinnati, we recently completed a study through Health Landscape that showed that locally for Cincinnati, African-American physicians only represent 2.1% of our local physician population, with Asians about 16% and others at 3%. So we have a national problem and we have a local problem.
Yeah, I want to just add to what Barb has said. I think that when we look at this notion, it is very multifaceted and very much tied up with the socioeconomic and social determinants of health issues that we are now been talking about, at least in the last 5 to 10 years. So when a young family or a young child looks up to determine, you know, what am I going to be when I grow up? Who do they see? And so we haven't figured all of that out. There is no silver bullet. But what we know for sure is that we have to begin at the core. And in this particular instance, we're talking about the family. And we're talking about getting our children prepared for kindergarten. And we're talking about getting our children prepared for fourth grade and eighth grade and, you know, getting them out of high school and getting them prepared for college and tech school or all those different kinds of things in order to bring them together. When we hear the old African proverb, it takes a village. In this particular case, when we're talking about getting that pipeline that Barb is talking about, that's what's going to have to happen in order for us to meet this need.
And Gary, do medical schools need to step up their outreach efforts to minority students? How do they do that?
Yeah, absolutely. And they have been attempting that for a number of years. I seem to remember an initiative that they did back in the 90s called 3000 by 2000. And the objective was to get 3,000 underrepresented in medicine students, which would encompass Hispanics, Native Americans, African Americans, and Pacific Islanders and such, to have 3,000 graduates or enrolled medical students in U.S. medical schools by 2000. They didn't hit that goal. They have several programs that are sponsored by medical schools and by even hospital systems. I mentioned Ohio Health recently. They actually have a program for underrepresented minorities to actually give them some stipends and direct them to some of these hospital systems in the central Ohio area. So they're working on that. So there are a number of programs out there, but it goes back to what my colleagues on this programs that it has to start very, very early for potential students to recognize the opportunities out there in these science and math and technology fields and not be fearful of them, but see them as potential opportunities for them.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join our conversation. And Karen, we were talking about the doctor-patient relationship earlier. When you talk about that trusting relationship between the provider and the patient, are we talking about that the patient's more willing to take the advice if they feel the provider knows their customs, their culture, and that their background, and even things as down to knowing specific diet trends.
Yeah, that is absolutely true. But we have to be very careful here. And this is what we were talking about earlier, that, you know, oftentimes I've had people say, so are you saying that because I'm a white physician or a white nurse that I can't take care of an African-American patient correctly? In some instances, the answer may be yes. But in all instances, the answer is not yes, because you absolutely can, you know, learn the cultural differences and idiosyncrasies that exist in a particular individual. However, having said that, there are particular individuals that really do need to see that person who looks like them, who really does have the dialect that individual has, to help them to feel comfortable to be able to really take that information in a way that they will use it. You know, our world is so different. Our country is so different. You know, we have grown up in a society where we really are able to kind of do and say what we want to do here in America. And all of those things come to play, even as it relates to our health care. You know, when I talk to students at the university, at the College of Nursing, I said, you know, only in America can we say, you know, when the doctor tells you, you really need not to eat that, you know, eat all of that sugar, we can say, well, I want to anyway, knowing that it's going to do something to us. In America, we're allowed to say that. So we really have to find a really, when we talk about cultural sensitivity, we really have to find not only something that's culturally sensitive, but also socially acceptable for the individual, because in America, we're allowed to do what we want to do, and whether it's good for us or not. So it's all of those things combined that we're talking about.
Karen, do you know if this pertains? Did you want to say something, Gary? Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to piggyback on what Karen was saying about the fact that U.S. medical schools are being required by the Liaison Committee on Medical Education, which is the accreditation body for these medical schools, to teach in their curriculum cultural competence to all medical students. So it's not as though just because I'm an African American, I, you know, have a broad understanding
That's
of
right.
all other cultures as minority cultures.
That's right.
But it's becoming a mandate, or it is a mandate, not becoming, it is a mandate of all medical schools to teach your students about work in various cultures and such. I had one student several years ago that just said, in a course that I was teaching, well, I don't plan to work with those people anyway. And so that was kind of like that social incompetence mm-hmm. that existed a decade mm-hmm. or more that, well, I can pick and choose where I'm going to work at. Not in this day and age.
That's correct. And I think that all of the health career colleges now have that requirement. In fact, hospitals, at least those hospitals that are accredited by the Joint Commission of Healthcare Organizations, that those hospitals that receive Medicare funding, are all required to ensure that the providers that practice in those organizations are culturally competent. I think that all of us would say that we're still challenged by really measuring that cultural competency. I think we're still challenged by knowing whether or not they are, but indeed we're all expected to provide that.
Yeah, I agree with Gary and Karen. I just want to add that sometimes it's more helpful to use the word structural competence. As we learn about the social determinants of health, whether it's background, ethnicity, language, education, diversity elevates us all. Just as women have changed the face mm-hmm. of medicine, so too, as we have a healthcare professional pool that reflects our population both locally and nationally, then we're better able to respond to the needs of all.
Barbara, do we know, we talk about race and ethnicity. Does age play a role in any of this? And Karen's shaking
yes.
her head too, so
no.
you may both want to weigh in. Gary's saying, oh yes, you may want to weigh in on this.
Sure. Medical students are typically start medical school when they're about 22 years old and finish when they're about 26 years old. So because they're relatively young in their professional lives, they don't have the life experiences, sometimes the maturity, to be able to respond to patients' specific needs based on age as well. However, I think that comes, and there's sort of a general acceptance that empathy can be learned. So just as we teach medical interviewing, we believe that these things can be taught. So structural or cultural competence can be taught. A young person can be taught to be responsive to an older adult's needs and medical issues.
Yeah, I would just add to that, when you think about the generational differences of our students as well as the clients that they may serve, and overlay that with the race and ethnicity, it becomes even more complicated, particularly at a time when we have individuals who are laden with chronic disorders that have complicated their lives. And so it just is becoming a more very complex industry, if you will, and really then makes it more complicated for those of us who are in the educational field in finding those individuals who have the potential to really move into these professions, because we really need strong individuals who are sound critical thinkers, as well as the characteristics of being able to manage these complex issues that we're discussing today.
Gary, did you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, you know, this concept of the structural or cultural competence is really a journey as opposed to just a destination.
Yes.
Where I'm a card-carrying holder of this because, you know, this is so multifactorial. It's not just race, ethnicity, age, sexual preference. It is so multi-layered and such. And so one of the many things that we do when we're recruiting applicants to our medical school is we look at what their life journey has been up to that point. Have they been a very giving person? Do they communicate well? Do they listen well? What have they traveled the world? At Wright State, we're currently in the orientation process, and I actually left that just to come to this phone call. And we asked, well, how many of you speak different languages? 70% of our students speak different languages. 70% of them have traveled to other countries outside of the United States and such. And so it's a very diverse tapestry of students that come together, and the first thing that we teach them, the first course that we teach them, is human development, which talks about these very issues.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join the conversation. Let's talk with Deborah in North College Hill. Good afternoon, Deborah.
Good afternoon.
What's
I guess the main thing I'm getting from all of this is that they're starting to address this, I guess, in medical school or maybe when they're almost finished. It just seems like it's happening all way too late. It seems to me that they need to start identifying potentially as maybe their freshman year of high school or maybe even as early as middle school. It just seems if you're waiting to address cultural issues that far, or, I mean, that advanced into their career, it's almost too late.
Actually, Deborah, you're absolutely correct. We, you know, as I indicated, what we have found is that we really need to begin this process as early as pre-K, meaning before kindergarten. But because of the lack of numbers that we have today, we're kind of working at it from all angles. We're not only working at it as in preparing and looking for students who can get into med school and nursing school and pharmacy school and, you know, all of the various industries related to healthcare, but we're also working to find working with students who are getting ready to go into kindergarten and getting prepared for the fourth grade and getting them prepared for the eighth grade and getting them prepared for high school, etc., to develop that pipeline because the gap is so large. So you're absolutely correct.
It also seems to me it's not just a matter of when it's addressed, but who it's addressed by.
Yes.
You know, it's like you said, you know, the people who say, you know, I can't treat someone, you know, who's a different ethnicity or who has a different disability, you know, they're going to have to accept some of that judgment from people who are in those communities or, I don't know, just who are not like them. They're going to have to accept that judgment. There's going to have to be, I don't know, some more, a way of doing that. I don't know how that would be done. But there is going to have to be more people of a more diverse background making those judgment calls.
I think Karen brought up a good point earlier that family needs to be involved in this. Parents need to be involved in this as well. Deborah, thank you for your comments. We appreciate them. Let's talk with... Did you want to say something there, Gary? Sorry.
Yeah. I just wanted to point out, I agree wholeheartedly with the caller about trying to get this done early. And one of the oldest programs that we have at Wright State University is the Horizons in Medicine program, which just celebrated graduated its 36th class. And we go to the high schools and high school seniors and juniors and sometimes sophomores and talk to them about careers in medicine and nursing and medicine, physical therapy, and so forth. And so we have about between 20 and 25 students every summer that about 7% of them, 8% of them, have actually become practicing physicians since its inception with about 900 graduates and such. So we have to go there, but we have to go back farther and make families understand the importance of these science and math careers out there.
Let's talk with Gabe and Clifton. Good afternoon, Gabe. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you.
Great. And what's your question or comment?
I am an incoming medical student, and my question is, how do you weigh the needs of society to have a more diverse healthcare professional workers against the fairness of the incoming applicants, if you will? Because not being too far removed from the application process, I know that underrepresented minorities do have some preferences in sort of selection for many healthcare professional programs.
Well, actually, I guess I can weigh in a little bit about that because there was quite a bit of discussion in the summer of 2013 about the Fisher versus University of Texas at Austin affirmative action and such. And basically what the take-home message from that ruling is that medical schools need to consider ethnicity for students that are underrepresented or applicants that are underrepresented in medicine, but it's one element of a holistic admissions process. It can't be the only element. And so sometimes there's that social misunderstanding or misperception that that is the only thing that they do, because we have like 21 or so holistic measures that we use to look at applicants at Wright State. So it's not the only thing.
And I would just like to add that one of the things that we've learned over time, and that medical schools and other healthcare colleges across the country, and I've been privileged to help to co-lead a national look at holistic review, and that is that there are more characteristics to success in higher education beyond GPA and standardized testing. And so we know based on the research that there are individuals who may do very, very well as it relates to their GPA and standardized tests, but don't do as well in the practice of whatever their chosen profession may have been. And so now we look at these various characteristics and put them all together to make the decision. It is not the intent in any way to bring anyone into the profession who is not excellent. It's all about excellence and being able to help to close the health disparities gap by doing this, not in any way to lower the quality or the standards of the individuals who are practicing.
That's a good point, because it doesn't do anybody any good if we do that.
That's exactly right.
Let's speak with Mark in Evansville. Good afternoon, Mark.
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Sure can.
Okay. I'm calling because I have a daughter who is going to be a senior in high school next year, and she has been selected to be a Ohio delegate to the future Congress of Medical Leaders in D.C. in November. Now, I'm trying to get her mentors because she wants to be a doctor, and I'm having some difficulties because they can, you know, check with several people, and they haven't got back with me, but I want to know if the guests know of any type of mentoring organization specifically for females, because she's African-American, that could be used to help my daughter in this senior year process to, really target her studies and so forth to achieve that goal of becoming a doctor.
Sure.
Okay, Mark.
So a couple things, just in terms of a one-on-one mentor, I would really encourage your daughter to talk to her family doctor and her pediatrician or pediatrician. That's often the best relationship. And we, many med students have shadowed in their physician's office, had some one-on-one conversations. That's the person who's interacted the most with her as a mentor. We also have programs in our city designed to help support students in their exploration of health careers, including medicine. One is called TAPMD that is sponsored by the Hospital Systems and University of Cincinnati, and her high school guidance counselor may be able to give her more information about that. That's also an important place to start and to let the high school guidance counselor at your school know of your daughter's interests and ambitions in going to medical school so that she, he or she can keep their eye open for additional programs. We do have a dual admissions program at UC where upon entrance to since University of Cincinnati, there's also provisional acceptance to the College of Medicine, and that's called Connections. And there's mentoring and guidance to support students there too. But her high school guidance counselor may be helpful.
Let's speak with Mandy in Milford. Good afternoon, Mandy. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
What's your question or comment?
Sure. My comment is I work for Great Oaks campuses here in Cincinnati. And we do have a great number of programs available for juniors and seniors so that they can experience the healthcare profession right off the bat.
That's a great plug for Great Oaks. And full disclosure, my sister's the principal at Diamond Oaks, so I'm a big fan. So I'm happy that you called and that you did the shout-out to the programs. You have excellent programs.
You know, I just think that with, you know, the idea that these students can go to high school but get college credit at the same time, they all get the PCA certification, the STNA certification. I think that's a great way for them to decide early if it's what they do want to do.
Yeah, I think as one of the callers pointed out earlier, the sooner we get people thinking about going into this profession, the better off we'll be. And Karen also pointed that out, too, that it's crucial to get kids thinking about going into the medical profession way earlier than what we do right now.
I also would say that the earlier that those of you who are parents and you've got your children in school, and if you will encourage them to really be serious with their math and their science education, that helps as well, because that is so important when we talk about these types of career fields.
Thank you, everybody, for joining me this afternoon. Greatly appreciated. Dr. Karen Bankston, University of Cincinnati College of Nursing Associate Dean of Clinical Practice, Partnership and Community Engagement. Dr. Barbara Tobias with the UC Department of Family and Community Medicine and Medical Director of the Health Collaborative of Greater Cincinnati. And also Dr. Gary Leroy, Associate Dean for Student Affairs and Admissions at Wright State University Boonshoff School of Medicine.